It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, where we check with reporters here in Northwest Indiana Media to find out more about the stories they've put out, in this case in print and online. And we're talking with Mary Frieda, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Mary, thank you for joining us in the program today.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
That's a great stories that you had out this time around. Let's talk first about the one that probably people forget about. There was a plan, that seems like forever, when the downtown Crown Point Theater was going to be revived and brought back to life. But unfortunately, there have been some legal issues involving the manager of the site. Tell us about the latest issues involving the man who ran the Crown Theater.
On Monday, the Indiana Attorney General's office requested a default judgment in its lawsuit against former project manager for the Crown Theater, Brad Strom. Now, the Indiana Attorney General's office filed a lawsuit against Strom in August on allegations that he violated the consumer protection laws that Indiana has, as well as the senior consumer protection laws the state has. And in this lawsuit, it shed light on various times where consumers asked Strom for refunds, and those refunds were never received. Strom had cited, delays in construction on the theater, and its opening just continued to get pushed back without a date in sight. And in this lawsuit that was filed in August, there were originally a handful of complainants, around 20, and then in October, the case was amended to include 46 consumers.
Wow.
Now, the latest news Monday was, in their filing, the Attorney General's office asked for a default judgment for these consumers to get their money back for the tickets for shows that never went on and money they never received.
Mm-hmm.
And this filing was done early Monday morning. From what I could tell, I had checked about 10 a.m. And by 4 p.m. Monday, the judge in the case had accepted the default judgment and ordered the case be closed. Now, what that means for consumers is they could potentially see their money back, but there's no guarantee they'll ever see a cent back from the money that Strom took from them for shows that never occurred.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that there were two other default judgments that Strom had faced. Tell us more about those.
Yes. So the first is a case that's unrelated to the Crown Theater in general. It's a small claims case that mm-hmm. occurred earlier in the spring. Now, that judgment resulted in about $4,000 Strom has to pay back to the person in this case. The other case related in judgment related to Crown Theater itself is a judgment that nears $280,000, similar to the amount in Monday's filing. And in that case, there's a civil lawsuit that alleged Strom never paid back a $70,000 loan to two Crown Point residents who gave him money to help get the theater up and running.
Yeah.
Now, it's important to note, Chris, that in all of these cases, save for the small claims case, Strom did not respond or try to act, or an attorney didn't act on his behalf to respond to these cases. According to court filings, he showed up for a hearing in the small claims case where he has been ordered to pay around $4,000, but in the cases that include the Crown Theater, he's kind of ghosted the courts on them.
It sounds like that. Yeah, this has been the problem that he apparently has had here, and that the latest case, the latest default judgment that was coming down from the AG's office case is mm-hmm. because he didn't show up in court to answer to that, too, I understand.
Yes, that is correct. It's the same. He didn't participate in this case, nor in the case in which he allegedly did not pay back that $70,000 loan.
We had a couple other stories in the Times. In fact, I guess they're both really related holiday stories, but one is about crime and one is good things. Let's talk about the package theft story. I'm surprised we haven't seen or heard more of problems with package thefts because of so many deliveries that have to be made these days.
Yes. Well, police say that they are surprised. Well, many law enforcement agencies, I should say they're surprised by the low number of package thefts in the region this year, given the demand for online ordering. But many of them note that, we're just on the cusp of the holiday season where folks are really starting to order presents and have them delivered to their homes. And many of package thefts just don't go reported. Many police officers and departments told me in my course of this story, a lot of folks will you know, mention these package thefts on Facebook, posting videos of the theft or even on the neighbor's app, but many times police said that they aren't reported to their local agencies. It's also important to note that many police departments believe that these thefts just have remained low during the pandemic because somebody is always home, and because of the cost, the low cost, rather, of home security systems such as the Ring doorbell.
I guess that's the advantage of being stuck at home, either having to stay at home because you're working from your home or because you have family members you have to take care of during the pandemic here, that if you hear the doorbell ring or if your smartphone chimes up and tells you, hey, you've got a package to pick up, you go right out to the front door and there it is.
Yes, I suppose that is a perk of being at home.
It's not exactly the happiest perk, but I suppose it's one of the things you can look forward to, I know. Well, we talk about here about a sad story about package thefts for the holidays, but you have a good story, too, about the need for hundreds of angels to help fulfill some Christmas wishes here in Lake County. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, late last week, Kevin Feldman, the director for the Lake County branch of the Salvation Army, had made mention that there are many families still in need of Christmas gifts and in need of these angels. The Salvation Army has an annual angel tree program where angels adopt families or children and adopt, you know, in quotes here, because they will purchase them Christmas gifts based off of a wish list provided by a child or a family. And this year that need has increased by 3 times, Feldman told me in an interview last week. And so he wants to be sure that no families are left behind. And I talked to him this morning, just before we chatted, just to see how that's going. And he said angels are still needed. After the article came out, he said a lot of folks did reach out and were finding ways to donate toys to the Salvation Army, but that does not diminish the need the Salvation Army has. In fact, he's anticipating some more families to come forward asking for angels to help them out this Christmas.
Now, what does the Salvation Army have to do now because of the pandemic? Have they had to just basically completely change things around? They used to have physical trees that they used to put angels on to let people know that, you know, that they could help support a family for the holidays, but can't do that now. What's the case now?
Yes, well, I should point out, Chris, that there are still some angel trees located in person in locations around the region. In a Walmart or a Sam's Club, you'll be able to find an angel tree and pluck off a tag in person. Now, Feldman did note that these trees are not located at the front of the store to help with congestion. They're located farther back, and volunteers aren't there to kind of explain what angel tree is. But the Salvation Army also launched a virtual angel tree program this year, which is found online. And those angels are the same angels that you would, you know, take a tag off the tree for. And Feldman said that this is just another way the Salvation Army can expand its reach in finding angels for these Lake County families. If you log on to the website, you can see all the angels that are still in need and their age and their gender and how many and what gifts, rather, that they have asked for this year. The Salvation Army provides guidelines on what to do once you've purchased these gifts and where to take them or drop them off at. Alternatively, gifts can be purchased from the Salvation Army's wish list from Walmart.com, where folks can just add toys to their shopping cart and just send them directly to the Salvation Army in Munster.
Mary Frieda is a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. We've found out about the stories that she's had out there in print and updates as well, too. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
And we're checking in with reporters here in the region to find out about the stories that they have out there in print and online. And we have Times reporter Carly Lanich with us. She covers a lot of educational news and quite a few that she's had here recently. And first off, Carly, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first thing we got down here is talking about money, especially as far as the Crown Point School District is concerned. They have some very ambitious plans for expansion of facilities and some improvements as well. And they've had to, I guess, make the first disclosure of how much it's really going to cost. Tell us about that story, please.
Absolutely. So this is a big project, and it's been a long time coming, as Crown Point has seen just tremendous growth. Anyone who's in or around South Lake County has seen just the houses that are springing up. So the district launched a facilities survey or study a few years back, and initially they moved very quickly at their Winfield Elementary to expand. They saw that area as a pressing need. Now they're taking the time to look district-wide to see how can we address the growth we're seeing. Even before the pandemic, space was a big concern, right? So school leaders brought kind of a first look at what these projects could bring last month. They detailed improvements they hope to see at the high school level in a couple of their elementaries, and then kind of the big focal point of this project, I think, will be likely a replacement for Taft Middle School. And they're looking at a brand new building with this. So that all was introduced to the public last month. Now we're getting a look at the price tag. So school leaders will have a second hearing on Monday and then look to enter some bonds to finance this. The total that they think the projects could cost is about $214 million. Now, they'll ask a little more for insurance purposes, other expenses, but this is something that the district thinks it can do entirely without changing its tax rate. So they have some existing debt falling off, so they'll replace that with these new projects. But that's really a big deal. There's not many school corporations in Indiana these days that can bring this level of building, including a new school, without turning to voters for a referendum.
Yeah.
So this will be fairly significant.
Well, it's certainly the case. As we all know, what happened in the Gary Community School Corporation, they had to go to the voters and ask for help to do all the work that they have planned. So it's not surprising.
Well, it's a little different in Gary. Now, they did turn to the voters recently for a referendum. That referendum is specific to more educational and operational expenses. They have set aside some money. It's guaranteed under House Bill 1065, freed up specific to their school corporation, given their financial standing, to help direct money for their project. A little bit different statutorily, but it is similar. The districts across Indiana are going out to their voters for referendums for multiple reasons, whether it's building or educational expenses. They're really having to rely on their communities. So to see Crown Point do this, something that they've been able to plan for, kind of had an idea that debt would fall off soon, it'll be a big deal. And I think from what we heard in the school board's meeting this week, there was, a business owner who stepped up and said, hey, I'm a taxpayer. I really appreciate that you're doing this in a way that, values our money as taxpayers and is getting children in our community the education that they deserve and they need. So that's really interesting to watch. Like I said, there'll be another meeting on Monday, and I'm already starting to hear some parents maybe planning to come out and express, their opinions both on the building projects and just on the nature of learning these days in a virtual environment.
Yeah, I'm sure they'll have something to say if they have the opportunity to participate in the school board meeting coming up here as to whether the bond issue goes through as it is or if they're going to do some concern about it, to be sure.
Absolutely.
One of the other stories that you had out there in print and online, of course, brings us up to date on how the school systems in Northwest Indiana are doing and trying to deal with the coronavirus pandemic. And I guess we have more schools that are trying to get back into different modes of learning these days. Bring us up to date, please, on the issues.
Sure. So this week's kind of a pivot point. I think a lot of people, looking at Thursday, Friday's COVID numbers, we'll be watching very, very closely. We know there's a little bit of lag in reporting when folks are getting tested. So we've heard from the state that really later this week is when we'll see that kind of residual effect show in the data from Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of school leaders are going to be looking to that, looking to see what those numbers show. Now we have, a large number of districts that turned to temporary virtual learning. Some of them said, hey, we're going to go just a couple weeks outside of Thanksgiving to give, families the time to distance and recollect and assess the data. It was also a time to allow, we were seeing a large number of quarantines. Speaking of Crown Point, for example, there was at one point they saw almost 10% of their in-person population was in quarantine or isolation, not necessarily because they had the virus, but maybe they came into contact with someone who did. So we're starting to see now there's a few districts, Lake Central, for example, a few districts that have decided to finish with their last week or two of the semester in person before going to winter break. And then there's several others that'll be making returns. They hope after winter break. So there's really a wide variety of plants. I always tell folks, check in with your school because it's changing very quickly.
Yeah.
But the overall, sense that we're getting here is just that school leaders are trying to do the best that they can for their communities. They're trying to balance, what parents want, teachers' concerns for safety, keeping space in schools, and just keeping an eye on what health officials are recommending during this time. So we did see some of those quarantine numbers come down as schools went virtual. That has had an effect on the numbers. Now we'll be watching to see what the residual effects are of the holidays and kind of the remaining impact of bringing people back together in person again when that happens.
I know one of the stories that you also had in here recently involving the pandemic and education talks more about higher education in particular. We're getting close to, of course, the Christmas and the New Year's breaks, but I'm sure that the universities and colleges are looking to try and start something in the early part of next year. What's the latest that we know right now?
The most concrete plan that I've heard so far that was communicated very early on in the school year was from Indiana University.
Mm-hmm.
They decided, even prior to starting their fall semester, their plans for the entire school year. So they are taking a winter intercession, if you will, for in-person learning, rather than kind of playing it wait as you see. They'll be planning for a period extending from about Thanksgiving to early February. It's about an 8 to 10 week period of solely online learning. Now, I've talked to folks at IU Northwest. The campus is open if there's folks who feel comfortable, maybe need a space to connect to the internet or study somewhere quiet. But all of those classes that students are taking, they will be online. So, earlier in the school year, we're still seeing a large number of online classes, but there were some lab classes, meetings where it really made sense to be in person in safe environments. That's all going to be online until it looks like early February.
Mm-hmm.
I've connected with folks at PNW. They're taking a look at hopefully kind of a model similar to what they've done in the fall semester. We're constantly checking in with our sources to see what the change will be, if any, coming back from winter break. As everyone knows, things are moving very quickly these days. So we're staying on top of it when those changes and announcements come.
Carly Lanich is an education reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and she's told us about her stories that she has in print and out there online as well, too. And Carly, as always, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it.
Edgewater Health here in Northwest Indiana is holding a virtual fundraiser on December 10th and has some interesting guests and interesting topics that will be brought up. Let's find out more about the event coming up. Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the Edgewater President and CEO, and she's joining us from her office. Thanks for being with us today.
Hello, Chris, and thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Tell us a little more about the event that is coming up, this fundraiser on December 10th, some of the guests and other people who are going to be involved, and some of the important things that you want to be able to put forth as far as a fundraiser is concerned for Edgewater Health.
Okay. Well, Chris, this will be our very first annual virtual fundraiser. I'm not sure that it will be annual, but it's our very first virtual fundraiser. And so it's giving people an opportunity to learn more about Edgewater during these very challenging times, and giving them an opportunity to ask questions or, just really come to know who we are, what we do in the community. I think you know, Chris, that Edgewater has been around for about 47 years now, so mm-hmm. we'll be coming up on our 50th anniversary in 2 to 3 years. And originally, we provided behavioral health care services for mental health and addictions. But since that time, we've come to recognize that there is an association between mental and physical health, because if you have poor mental health, you're at risk for chronic physical conditions and vice versa. Poor physical health conditions result lots of times and put you at risk for conditions that are related to poor mental health. And so in 2015, we brought on our primary care arm. So we mm-hmm. provide family medicine and treat a range of physical conditions there. And so we want people to know exactly what it is we do. And during these times, we are one of those organizations in the community that provide services to people who are uninsured and underinsured. And so we're here to make sure that we're providing quality healthcare services to our community. And our fundraiser is going to give an opportunity. Of course, I'll be there giving a welcome address, and we'll have our board chair doing an address as well. But we will be speaking about our programs, our services, and even our employees who are not only first responders in the fight against COVID-19, but they're the backbone of Edgewater Health. Mm-hmm. And without their courage, hard work, dedication, achieving the goals of making our communities healthier, that would be absolutely impossible. So we're also going to have, we're inviting as a celebrity guest, Val Warner. Many of you may be familiar with her from ABC 7 Chicago's Windy City Live. Mm-hmm. She'll be there. We'll also be doing a special screening of a film, Goners. And Goners is one of the many films that Edgewater has produced. It's been directed by Mark Spencer. Many of you might know Mark from the West Side Theater Guild. And this one is about teen suicide. And it's very timely because you know that during these times, especially now with people being so isolated and removed from their everyday sort of social interactions, they become more depressed and anxious, and suicide rates have gone up tremendously since COVID-19 started, this whole entire pandemic. And so it's a very timely topic. And so the film is probably about 20 minutes long. So we're going to do a screening of that particular film during our fundraiser as mm-hmm. well. And so we're just asking people to donate if they can, whatever they can, to help us provide COVID-19 testing, which we're doing a lot of, flu vaccinations in this season, crisis intervention, so we can go into the homes and intervene, or if people come into our clinics, intervene when we feel that they are reaching a crisis state, and just our traditional normal family and youth programs. We want to continue to be able to do those. So our fundraiser is on December 10th, and it screens at 7. And on, it's a virtual fundraiser, and we've sent out the link to most people.
Okay.
But I can give you that as well again. And we're just looking forward to having a wonderful audience to come and take advantage of the program, the fundraiser, kind of get to see what we do and enjoy some wonderful entertainment at the same time.
I know that the physicians and staff there at Edgewater Health do their best to create some wonderful moments for people that are in real trouble. And especially now during the pandemic, it's been especially bad. You've referred to some of these issues already with isolation that are causing more mental health problems for many people here in Northwest Indiana. Are you able to tell us about maybe some success stories where some serious problems got headed off because of some early intervention by the staff members and all, somebody that came in or somebody that was maybe a visitor in the past and came back asking for help?
Yes. Well, during these times, we've actually had, well, you know, for a while, people weren't able to get out because of all of the restrictions, and
right.
some were even just simply afraid to go out. And so many of them were experiencing like physical health crisis or mental health crises, but they were afraid to come in. So what we've been able to do is to provide technology, and we'll send out a worker in the community, an outreach worker, a medical assistant. They actually have gone into the homes of several people and hooked them up so that they could do a telehealth session with our physician, and the physician's been able to assist them right there in their own homes without them having to leave their homes. And so
That's
we're
great.
Very proud of being able to do that.
That's great. And you know, obviously, you're looking for the financial help at this time of year to be able to keep things running and the like. And is that what you're hoping and more to gain from the fundraiser coming up on December 10th?
Absolutely. We can always use more funds to do the things that we do because we pride ourselves in not only being a provider of services for physical and mental health, but also for social health as well. We provide housing to individuals, assist them in providing housing, finding housing. We get them referred to and supported by other community organizations for food and things that they might be in need of. And so we're always looking for ways that we can continue to provide those services, and so your financial assistance is always helpful, and we'll want to continue to be able to do that. But more importantly, we want to let people know that we are here in the community. We have several locations. We're soon to be opening up a location in Merrillville. I'm really happy about that.
Oh, good.
We're in Gary and Griffith right now. We'll be in Merrillville, I would say, within the next 90 to 120 days. And so we're just looking forward to expanding our services and serving as many individuals, as many families as we possibly can.
Now, if you will, give us that link that you mentioned that you have for people that would have already received it. But if anybody does want to be able to watch and participate in the virtual fundraiser coming up on December 10th, how can they do so now?
The best way to do it, because there is a link and it's so complicated to say it, but the best way I would say is to go to our website, www.edgewaterhealth.org, and there is a link there that will allow you to link directly on to the page and be able to participate in the fundraiser.
Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes is the president and CEO of Edgewater Health. Thank you very much for being with us, and the best of luck for the virtual fundraiser, the very first and hopefully the only one that you have done coming up on December 10th here in Northwest Indiana.
Thank you, Chris, and I just say to you and to all of your listeners, stay safe and healthy, and thank you for your consideration.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. There could be some help for businesses and nonprofits who are affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke recently with Indiana Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, and here's the conversation.
It's a third COVID relief package.
That is correct. Back in April, our Office of Community and Rural Affairs, you know, we began addressing the COVID-19 impact on Indiana communities. And since that time, since April, we have awarded 112 grand in 62 communities, totaling almost $21 million through the COVID response plan. So this is a third round of those COVID response grants. And what makes this round of grants different is that it includes not only our non-entitlement communities, but our entitlement communities. And our local units of government can apply for up to $250,000 for a grant. And the eligible activities include mental health services, child care services, public Wi-Fi locations, food pantry or food bank services, and then subsistence payment programs. Or it can also be used for grants or loans to businesses to retain their low and moderate income jobs. So this phase three will be once again a competitive process, and it is available to local units of government. So what typically we see happen is that a local unit of government will partner with a nonprofit to provide perhaps child care services or to be able to address the mental health issues in their community. And so while the local unit of government is applying for the resources, in many instances, they will be partnering with a nonprofit to be able to deliver those services. But we look at this as really an opportunity to continue to support our local units of government and our communities throughout Indiana as families and businesses are struggling to overcome the challenges of COVID-19.
Has any local governments from Northwest Indiana gotten these grants?
Yes, absolutely, Sharon. In our first phase, our first round of grants, which was in April of this year, the town of La Crosse in LaPorte County was awarded $10,000 to install 4 Wi-Fi hotspots. The city of Knox in Stark County was awarded $250,000 for local businesses for job retention. And then the town of Hebron in Porter County was awarded $152,500 to create a fund to provide short-term working capital to small businesses to retain jobs. That was all in round one. Now, the second round of grants that was awarded in August of this year, LaPorte County was awarded $250,000 to be able to provide payroll assistance grants and working capital to businesses. Pulaski County was awarded $250,000 to provide grants to assist small businesses that were impacted by the pandemic. And then North Judson in Stark County was awarded $250,000 to start a revolving loan program to help businesses retain jobs and stay open. So we have seen Northwest Indiana be a beneficiary of our COVID-19, of those $21 million in grants that we have already awarded. And we encourage them to, again, apply for this very next round of the grant. As I know that there are still families and still businesses that are overcoming the challenges of COVID-19.
When will the grant funds be available and how do you apply?
Well, what the proposals will be accepted through January 29th. So they do have some time to go ahead and submit their grant. And then the OCRA will work with them on their proposals and to give them technical assistance. And then the application actually closes on February 26th. So they'll have to get a written proposal to OCRA by January 29th, kind of outlining their program and what they intend to do. Then OCRA will work with them on their application process to be sure they have a good application, and then those will be due by February 26th. Proposals are due the 29th of January, but the actual applications are due the 26th.
When do you think the grant monies would be awarded?
You know, that we do a pretty quick turnaround. So once those applications are in place, it usually takes about a month, month and a half to go through all the applications and check for compliance. So it would be this spring that the money would be made available to the community.
Do you have any...
Or this coming spring in 2021.
Any stories in your mind of any small businesses that were saved because of this grant?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Well, I'll tell you what is really interesting is one community provided Wi-Fi hotspot in their county or in their city because there was no Wi-Fi availability. And so they provided it in their courthouse in that area and the parking area around the courthouse. And they actually had children come to the courthouse in order to do their e-learning. Had that hotspot not been put in place, those children wouldn't be able to participate in e-learning, nor would people be able to get telehealth services or even do any kind of teleworking. So, you know, it's hard to believe that we have communities that still do not have good internet connection, but that is the reality. And that's just one small story of how this grant money made a difference.
Nice. And what community was that?
It was the town of Liberty. Sharon, I remembered more than I thought.
Well, that's great.
I appreciate you getting that information out to your local communities, but I know we'll probably see some interest in some applications. So thank you for helping us with that. Stay safe and healthy.
That's Indiana Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch speaking this week with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. Our thanks to Dr. Danita Johnson-Hughes, who's the president and CEO of Edgewater Health, and today to Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson and to Times of Northwest Indiana reporters Mary Frieda and Carly Lanich for being on the program today. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks very much, and we'll be back with you on Monday.